Hello, friends. Welcome to this month's episode of Tim's Travails, where our host, Timothy Trainer, takes us on a journey with other attorneys. Tim is also, of course, an author with a specialty in China, fiction and nonfiction. And he's just bringing so many cool blog posts. I hope you check it out, timothytrainer.com. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of this show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV. And you can also find our podcasts on Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. You are going to be fascinated by today's guest, Mark Cohen. Welcome, Mark. Mark is a non-resident fellow at the National Bureau of Asia Research and the University of California, San Diego. He serves as a guest professor at Renmin University in Beijing and on the advisory boards of the Asia Society. But his background is amazing, intense, and profound. I'm going to throw it over to Tim to talk about all of that. So take it away, Tim.
Thank you very much, Hope. Mark, great to see you. Glad you're here. And thank you so much for agreeing to do this morning. So hopefully.
My pleasure.
It's been a while since we spoke. To me, you're the China guy, and you have been for many, many years. I was trying to recollect, we never worked together at the USPTO. It was after I left, and I think you came, that we actually got together and a few times, maybe in places like a Geneva, Switzerland, or something like that for meetings. But you've been doing a lot of things other than just the PTO. As Hope alluded to, I mean, you fill a lot of different spots in lots of different places. So let's go back a little bit and say, where did the China spark come from for you?
Yeah, I usually respond to that question by posing another question, which is, if you looked at people who studied Chinese in the 1970s, and I was in that cohort, there were one of two reasons, typically. Actually, there was a third. They were ethnically Chinese, and it was a gut course in college for them because they already spoke Mandarin. But putting that group aside, there was one group that was, defense establishment / CIA. Maybe they wanted to be in the State Department. That's where they were headed. I mean, it was an exotic language that they thought could probably advance their career. And the other group were kind of would-be hippies who were reading poetry by Gary Snyder and the Beatniks and had a lust for travel and wanted to do something exotic and probably a romanticized image of China. So I usually say, which one do you think I fell into? And of course, if you saw a picture of me from the 1970s with my long hair and all that, I think the answer would be quite obvious. It was an exoticism. My brother actually also studied Chinese. Mm-hmm. He's a Qigong master and Tai Chi master. And we joke that we learned Chinese so we could speak Chinese to each other and our parents would not understand. So we kind of the same direction, although Ken likes to say that he studies ancient China and I focus on modern China. And to a certain extent, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's certainly the case with your career anyway. I mean, so that's the 1970s. What's the advice you give to people that want to study Chinese these days?
Well, first of all, it wasn't that easy in the 1970s to find a job. I mean, not to soft pedal it, but you're competing against folks who are Chinese American who spoke the language fluently, if it's just the language. And I think you're also competing with a lot of stereotypes. People would say, particularly after I graduated law school, they say they would only hire a Chinese because only a Chinese could understand Chinese if China is so mysterious. Or they would say they could only hire a non-Chinese because they don't trust anybody Chinese to do it. Both of them absolutely extreme that really avoided thinking about who was really the right person for the job. And then, beginning with normalization of relations and various other political or geopolitical moments, demand for Chinese lawyers generally went up. There were some times, like after Tiananmen, where it went down. And IP had its own kind of gradual escalation, really towards the late 90s with the WTO accession and negotiations over the WTO, which I think you might have been a part of, Tim. You started to see a greater interest from law firms and from China in intellectual property.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you say about how people looked at others studying Chinese or wanting to study Chinese, because I would say just a little distance away in Japan, it's a similar kind of thing that if you're not fully Japanese, you're never going to be Japanese, no matter how well you speak the language, and because of the nuances of culture, nuances of language, and so on. But the other interesting thing when I was studying in Japan back in the 70s is that if you were a second or third generation Japanese American going back to Japan, they didn't really trust them to be Japanese either because they didn't speak it well enough. And so there are some similarities that I hear when you talk about that from the Chinese perspective. It's similar in Japan.
I think one difference, and this may be based more on my personal experience, is that at least at various moments of openness in China, it's possible, I wouldn't say to blend in, you always stick out. Yeah, so people accept you even as a foreigner. And I think to the extent that, you've committed the time to study Chinese and learn the history and culture, all the more power to you, particularly in modern China where a lot of people don't have that background. I remember in my last dozen or so years, where I was a guest professor at Renmin University, as Hope just mentioned, one of the professors, after hearing me do an introductory comment to a conference on judicial enforcement of IP, where I talked about, I quoted from a poem from the 5th century BC on the importance of private property, or rather how in those days the king owned all the property and things were different now. And after that, he said to me, and I got a big round of applause. He said, after that, he said to me, every time you give a speech for me, you have to quote from Chinese poetry. That was his challenge to me. And that's what I did. In fact, every night before any kind of speech, there were many programs we did together, I would be up thinking about what possible poem can I interject that has some relevance. But they really appreciated that. And I took that as a very positive challenge.
So it's a bit of a different world today. So it's do you well, obviously people have more opportunities to study Chinese or in China to some extent, I guess, depending on the political atmosphere, how people feel about whether they want to even go to China right now, which is it's a unique period. But generally speaking, if we talk about the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's very different than when you were there. Started.
Absolutely. Yeah, very, very different. People didn't know if they could talk to you, frankly.
So, actually the last podcast we had, I don't know if you know Tom Moga, who did a Fulbright in China.
Sure, I know Tom very well.
And then every once in a while, if a student was very curious and asked the wrong questions, the security people might step in. But this was well, what did he say? Maybe in the early 80s or mid 80s, that time frame. So it's
Tom was fortunate, actually. I think after a while, before and after, they cut back on lawyers getting Fulbrights. They thought lawyers were just doing it to make the money. And I think that's certainly not, I mean, you don't make any money at that time by going to China and getting a lousy Fulbright stipend. But nonetheless, Tom was very fortunate. I think he had some great experiences.
So are you, do you run into a lot of students these days that are looking to go to China or?
Not so much. If anything, I think there's been a big drop off. The numbers of Americans enrolled in Chinese universities has declined dramatically. I think unfortunately we tend to be a pretty reactive culture. Often we're deciding to study something after the moment has crested, and then we drop it just at the time when it's starting to pick up again. So I remember I had my malpractice insurer had studied Persian. This was in the 1980s, after he graduated with his PhD in Persian, couldn't find a job, went into malpractice insurance, and I often think about him in terms of this political cycles and how they affect jobs. I don't think people really hire you for the language. I mean, that was my observation. It helps, but they're really hiring you for a skill set as a lawyer, an accountant, a business person.
Now, how long exactly was your time at the embassy as the intellectual property attaché?
So it's actually a little hard to calculate. It took 2 years to get all the approvals. So So I had two summers where I was not officially a part of the embassy. I was a detailee from the PTO. And then I had 4 years on the embassy or State Department payroll. And then after that, I spent another 2 years in Beijing with Microsoft and Jones Day. So it was 4+ years is what I would call it.
Okay. So that's actually a pretty significant amount of time to be there. I guess, how was your interaction with basically government officials at being a part of the embassy?
You know, I spoke to a lot of other people in my cohort. They weren't involved in IP. And I think the reaction, as I call it, is that it was like being on a honeymoon, except you didn't know you were on the honeymoon. So everything got worse after, and you realized, gee, that was the honeymoon. I should have been paying closer attention. I developed a lot of friends. I got a lot of favorable press. I was interviewed. I remember the China IP News, a weekly newspaper, even put me on their special edition of where they listed some of the subscribers who have supported the newspaper, you know, for many years. I mean, it was a lot of very, very nice things. I think in a moment where China was really exploring intellectual property, there was a hiatus in bringing like WTO disputes from around 2001 to 2007. So that wasn't hanging over people's heads. They wanted to learn. They were eager to learn. Agencies even that I dealt with. I was just thinking about that yesterday, as a matter of fact. The Ministry of Science and Technology had an IP agency within it, which actually was very active in prosecuting patents. I had very good relations with them. I don't even know if they still exist. And there's another one in the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology. Similarly, I don't even know if some of the folks who had this kind of IP consultancy in the ministry still exist, but everybody was interested. And they were curious, and I think they were also willing to accept what they thought was well-intentioned criticism. I think that the bridge, if you will, was a little broader in terms of what was acceptable conduct. I think today it's narrowed considerably.
Yeah. Now, I have to say that obviously I didn't spend near the time that you did in China. Most of mine were short pop-ins when it was a consultation team, interagency delegation going over for a week and maybe hitting Beijing, Shanghai, and one or two other cities and sitting across the table with you know, our Chinese counterparts. But I have to say, I was always impressed with their preparation, always impressed about how much they knew our system. And frankly, after I left the government and I would run into them, you know, if I was in China for some other reason, actually, you know, on the surface anyway, we got along just fine. And as an aside, I remember years later, I get a call from a lawyer up in Chicago who had a Canadian client having problems in China about a design patent issue. And they were getting basically they were getting stiffed by the local customs offices, because there was a local company that basically had stolen the design. And I said, well, I know the guy in Beijing who's who helped write the regs on the intellectual property enforcement for customs. So if they're working at the bottom level and working up, let me go to the top and see if we can do something working downward. And actually, within about 48, 72 hours between emails between me and the guy in Beijing, we resolved that one issue.
It was his last name, Lee.
I believe so.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah,
he was a dear friend.
Yeah, we actually, when I was in the government and we would do the bilateral consultations, you know, the cross table stuff sometimes wasn't very easy and wasn't very comfortable, right. And we were both doing our jobs. But then when I left the government and I was doing this on behalf of a client, I mean, he was extremely helpful. Made sure that the people locally understood what the regs were and what they were supposed to do, and what they were doing wasn't the right thing.
So I'll tell you an interesting story that's somewhat related to that. When I joined the government in 2001, September 5th, it was just before September 11th. Actually, I told folks I don't need to work on China. In fact, I'd like to have a change in pace. So I had an assortment of countries in South Asia, Southeast Asia, maybe even the Middle East. And it was the backup to the backup. You know who the two other backups were at the time. And anyway, it was the backup to the backup. First delegation to China after WTO accession comes along. The backup is not, the principal is not available and the backup is not available. And so they asked me, and I said, I'm happy to go, you know, I'm happy to go. So Joe Papovich was leading the delegation.
Yeah.
And one of our first meetings was with the chief judge of the IP division of the Supreme People's Court, then called the number three civil division. And Joe asked, well, do you have preliminary injunctions now for IP? Because WTO requirement didn't exist in China's civil law before. And he responds, we have provisional measures before the court opens. Now, you'd have to know Chinese to know that that is the literal translation of a preliminary injunction. Mm-hmm. But you'd have to know Chinese law. The translator did not. Oh, and Joe says, no, I want to know if you have preliminary injunctions. And Judge Zhang says, yes, we have preliminary measures before the court opens. Yeah. You know, he says it in Chinese, and it gets kind of boggled, you know, screwed up in translation. And then finally, I'm sitting on the far end because after all, I'm just like the backup to the backup. You can see Joe getting flustered. I said, Joe, he's responding to your question. That is how a preliminary injunction is now translated into Chinese.
Yeah.
And Judge Zhang sees me, says hello, because I knew him from a conference a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And Joe says, you're sitting next to me. And that was it. That was my 5-month effort to focus on things other than China came to a resounding crash. The next thing you know, the ambassador's chief of staff who was in the meeting says, I told the ambassador about you. He would like you to work in the embassy. And the next 2 years were spent on my going out to the embassy to do that.
Yeah.
But that was.
Well, clearly we may never have worked together at the PTO, but the people we know are certainly a similar pool of folks from back that period, because I don't know, I can't tell you how many trips I made to China with Joe Papovich as the head of the delegation, but certainly a fair number, I can tell you that. And it was actually a similar delegation practically every time to China. It was the same group of people when we were dealing with intellectual property issues anyways. So. Yeah. Once you get a decent team together, you keep it together for as long as you can if it's working.
Right.
But that was that's a great, you know, it's a great thing to have happen where you're able to actually help out and do that. Certainly from a language perspective, and I don't know who the U.S. translator was that for you at that moment in time. I just know that the embassy translator we had was pretty good. Might have been a different person from the one you're identifying. I don't really want to mention the name just because, usually the guy we had from the U.S. Embassy was very, very good. And actually I had the pleasure of having him actually here when I had a delegation of Chinese judges that came to the U.S. and he ended up being the translator, and I'd seen him on TV when he did that for Clinton, I think, when Clinton was in Beijing and others. So I felt very comfortable during that session with the Chinese judges. But, you know, I guess given that we've got maybe about 10 more minutes or so, or just maybe racing ahead to what we're seeing these days, what are the big, I don't know, obstacles, challenges right now, whether it's for people dealing with intellectual property from the U.S. government, dealing with their counterparts, or just the government in general dealing with their Chinese counterparts, whether it's State Department or anywhere else?
Yeah, well, you know, it's my sense is that there are tracks that are somewhat isolated from each other in engaging China on intellectual property. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has continued to talk with their Chinese counterparts. I think it's a monthly basis, bi-monthly basis, but this has been going on I think since Trump 1.0. A lot of it is about stuff that's, you know, relevant to filing examination patents, but some of it is broader than that. And that's good. On the other hand, I think USDR has been a bit more tied up in higher level political, you know, discussions, including WTO disputes at one time. Donald Trump filed a WTO case in his first administration involving technology transfer rules, and he won. Actually, I think he's the only president to have a win on an IP case with China, a very clear win. Part of it was, I think, because I helped feed him some of the, or his team, some of the information. But nonetheless, it's hard to say how folks are being engaged. I think the private sector has also been having some problems when the government efforts, you know, fall behind. We still have our PTO IP attaché in Beijing. Mike Mangelson is there. I'm not sure if Shanghai and Guangdong are staffed. I think companies are reorienting. Law firms certainly have. Most of the big law firms are closed, or they're considerably smaller. And of course, foreign law firms per se can't appear before Chinese courts, so they're limited. And there's no attorney-client privilege. So there's actually reasons not to open an office in China, although I don't think this has ever appeared as an issue. It's a theoretical issue. What you do have is a much more sophisticated China as well. You know, it's the biggest patent office in the world in terms of applications, biggest trademark office in the world, and certainly the most litigious in terms of numbers of cases. I think we are not at the end of China's evolution. I think China in certain areas is becoming an exporter of technology. We've seen this in standards essential patents, and we've also seen it now in biotech. China's the second largest exporter of pharmaceutical patented medicines, you know. And I think we're going to see, continue to see some growth along with some misestimations. There's also a lot of junk. People still patent in China for the wrong reasons. The Chinese IP system doesn't suffer from the disbelief that the U.S. IP system or even the European system has, where a lot of people think we don't need IP or IP goes too far. I think there's still a very big cohort of companies that support the IP system and a lot of expertise. And I share your observation, you know, when even as early as 15 years ago or so, you'd be talking about some development in the U.S. and the Chinese would know the ins and outs of it. Yep. Many of them were trained in the U.S. Some of them were trained about the U.S. So you have a pretty sophisticated group that's well positioned to exert greater influence than it has in the world. I think China has been a little bit reluctant for a variety of reasons. I think the system will continue to grow. Mm-hmm. I think it will compete with the U.S. and Europe and Japan and Korea. Politics can impact it. One of my greatest fears, just to throw this in, it's something I've talked about, is with the Trump focus on reciprocity in tariffs, one wonders if it's going to affect other areas of trade, which include intellectual property. Yeah. Are we going to start seeing countries make exceptions in how they protect American patents or trademarks or copyrights, spoken exceptions, or probably even worse, unspoken exceptions. Yeah. I think there's a possibility we head in that direction, and that would bring a significant change to a global IP system that was based on national treatment and most favored national treatment. So I'm concerned about that developing because I don't think you can build a global trade system completely on reciprocity.
No, I think, you know, what you've just raised would really be a deterrent to a lot of companies. And it doesn't matter what the nationality of the companies are when it comes to this issue of exceptions to intellectual property, because then all of a sudden investment decisions and things like that are immediately impacted. And I think, unfortunately, this is where the discussion about the term intellectual property, you know, puts people to sleep, but they don't understand the whole financial monetary things that are surrounding intellectual property when it comes to business decisions. And yeah, if you get enough exceptions put in place, it's certainly going to impact business decisions because, you know, why would you invest in a country at all if you may not get the full patent rights that you think you're going to get? So it becomes a problem. I think it's a broader issue than just the issue of patents per se, or trademarks or copyright. It's everything that flows from that investment or non-investment for that matter. I mean, either way.
And let me add, I think part of the issue right now is that law firms have left China and people are kind of being told to decouple, even though I don't think there's been decoupling in intellectual property. There's still filing of patents and trademarks, and thankfully it's technical enough that it doesn't have to look so political. But all of those things may have had some impact on decreasing interest in China by the business community or even the government community.
Well, I think the reality is that, you know, when you look at just the scale of bilateral trade and the impact the two countries have on the rest of the world, I think the idea that we can each go our separate way is just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And the reality is, I mean, we may have some issues here and there that cause some friction, but ultimately, I mean, I've always been impressed by the Chinese I've interacted with. And, you know, I think that what my fear is a miscalculation by somehow not respecting just how good or how well the Chinese can do things or engage in ways that we don't think of. I mean, we can't afford to have a superiority complex or having some disrespect on, you know, toward them, because you will underestimate their capabilities and it can be painful.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's a very common refrain. I think particularly from people who don't trust China, and they think that what do they know about the U.S. anyway? You know, they make an assumption that A, that they're not trustworthy, and B, they can't possibly understand what intellectual property is or what the U.S. does. And those are both wrong assumptions.
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, when I would sit back and think about the various governments during my time in government that I interacted with as a government official, I can say, I think pretty confidently, I never walked away from the table thinking that the Chinese delegation, anybody on the delegation, lied to me. That's not something I can say about all the other governments I've dealt with. I mean, most of them would skate the line, perhaps. Right. But I only had a couple that ever outright lied to me. And I can tell you that the ones that the people that I dealt with from China never did.
Yeah.
I mean, we all come close when we're across the table and negotiating and basically advocating for our governments. But I can't really ever point to, you know, a moment where I really thought the Chinese government officials were actually outright lying to us. I never thought that.
Yeah. No, I think I share that observation. In fact, I can remember some very heated discussions where we were definitely on opposite sides of the fence, and I doubt anybody had any motivation to lie because we were just completely on opposite sides of the fence.
Yeah.
In fact, one time, it was around 2017, we had a conference that was on technology licensing, and representative from the Ministry of Commerce was there. It was his second or third conference we were at together. He refused to change his opinion that Chinese law needed to be changed. And I said to him very directly, I said, I don't know who's going to make this decision, but I'm telling you, based on what you just said, you've bought yourself a WTO case and you're going to lose. As it turned out, Trump came to power and I proposed that particular issue as part of a WTO dispute, and we won it within a year. The law was changed. But, I mean, it was not anything I respected. He refused to lie. He said, no, I'm sticking by this. I said, well, I think you're wrong, and we'll see what happens. And it played out exactly as I thought it might.
Well, I certainly want to respect your time. I know you've got something else coming up. Any last words of wisdom about China-U.S. relations before we go?
The only thing I can say is it's become a much more difficult area to engage in. I think China is very suspicious of Americans these days. Americans are very suspicious of China. American policy is fairly unstable. The whole IP theft narrative from Trump won, it seems to be out the window in favor of just tariffs. I think China as a creative scientific force will only grow over time, so we can't afford to ignore it. And I think the Chinese intellectuals and otherwise are a pleasure to work with in general, even if you disagree with them. I've had a lot of great. I remember when we had a WTO case around 2007, and I was asked by USTR to fly in from Beijing to Geneva, and I get on these Air China flights, and all my Chinese friends, from different agencies there to defend. And we would sit and joke around each other. And then, of course, when we had to enter the halls in Geneva, we kind of separated with our various, country dolls. But we could be friends with each other despite being on opposite sides of an argument. I think many of those people I still count as my friends.
That's good to be able to say. Well, first of all, thank you very much. It's been an interesting discussion. Maybe, who knows, maybe this will be worth doing a second one if you're open to it down the roads at some point. But
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So anyway, good luck to everything you're doing. I mean, you seem to be staying busy and have your fingers in lots of different places, China related and otherwise. Hopefully, you're getting on it. I know you every once in a while you get out and do some things, and I see it on social media. So,
Yeah.
hopefully keep having a good time, and we'll get back together maybe down the road and chat about this and do this again.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you,
Thank
Hope. It's
you.
great.
Thank you
Great chatting
both.
with
Thank
you.
you both. To our audience, we really appreciate you tuning in for episode 4 of Tim's Travails, where you talked and listened to Mark Cohen, formal intellectual property attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, and a professor and senior tech fellow at the Asia Society, and oh, so many more things. So really fascinating, gentlemen. Very interesting to hear your insights into China, especially for lay people who don't have the expertise or insights that you do. Not always what the media is saying about it. So thank you both for your time. And we'll talk to you
Take
next
care.
time on Tim's Travails. Thank you for listening on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV.
Hey.
Hope Katz Gibbs, your producer. We'll talk to you soon.